Thank you, members. We'll call the joint hearing on Health and Human Services Reform and Health and Human Services Finance to order. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Really appreciate it. Just want to let you know, we, for the sake of today and just with so many people and wanting to cover a lot today, we're going to skip introductions for today and do those when we're in our respective normal separate committees. So we'll go through that exercise and get to know who everybody is on that day and the committee staff and everything. And so we will get right into it. The point of these next 2 days and these joint hearings is just to get everybody on the same page in terms of the main areas that this committee and the Health and Human Services Finance and Reform Committee are responsible for, the departments that we work with and their jurisdictions, get familiar with some of the faces and the populations that are served, and hopes that that will kind of give us a good overview for all things that we will be covering the next 2 years of this session. So with that and no further delay, we will first bring forward the Department of Health, and I believe we have Commissioner Ellinger here. So and members, just for your reference, today we're basically gonna hear from the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, the main departments that we work with, and getting an understanding of what they're responsible for, what they do, so we all are clear on that. So with that, thank you so much for coming, Commissioner Ellinger. It's great to have you, and you can start introducing yourself and then go from there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come before you this afternoon. And I will do a brief overview of the Department of Health, along with some background setting about a little bit about public health, given the context. And I have brought many of my assistant commissioners and my deputy commissioner and my budget team behind me, in case there are questions that I can't answer. They're here to certainly answer some of your questions. And I do have a handout for you, and
thank you. I do have a PowerPoint handout for you. I will not be going over all of those slides, but they're there for your reference. But in 1972, I graduated from medical school with the idea of going into becoming a GP in a rural practice somewhere. And it was, well, within 2 or 3 months after being in practice that I realized that I could be treating patients every day, being very busy for years and years and years, and I'd have an impact on the health of each individual patient. But because of the conditions within the community that I was working, the alcohol, the violence, the environment, the substance abuse, that I wasn't really going to have an impact on the overall health of that population that I was serving. And so I started looking around to see what else was there to really kind of address some of the multiple issues that I was seeing in my physician practice. And I really hearken back now as Commissioner of Health 100 years later, or from where when the health department was started. I graduated from medical school 100 years after the Minnesota Department of Health was created by Charles Hewitt, who was a physician from Red Wing, who started the health department because he had the same notion 100 years earlier that he could treat people, but there were so many other things leading to health. And he said, prevention first, cure if you must, capacity to do in both directions, which really is what public health is all about. It's really how do we treat and how do we prevent in the first place? How do we do both in the right fashion? And so as I was looking around at how to deal with a different way of approaching health, really came across public health for the first time, because we really didn't cover that in medical school. At that point in time, public health was really just one class about TV. But really discovered that public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. And those conditions were what I was seeing in my practice. And subsequently, we've discovered that the conditions that actually create health are multiple. Medical care, clinical care, certainly is one of those. It's a very important one, but really only accounts for about 10% of our overall health. Health behaviors really count about 30%. The social and economic factors in which people live in, about 40%. The genes that were given, 10%. And the physical environment, about 10%. So that if we're really going to create health, we really have to focus on all of those aspects, and we need to have them in a proper balance. It's certainly the World Health Organization put them in a little different context. If we're going to be healthy, you know, we need to have peace. We need to have good shelter. We need to have good education, food, income, stable ecosystems, sustainable resources, certainly health care, and equity, because we find that if we have inequitable conditions in society, it really does not lead to overall health for everyone. And certainly as we look at what's gone on over the 100 years in the 20th century, we gained 30 years of additional life, and 25 of those years were really because of the public health activities. Really about 5 of those were because of the medical care, so both are really needed. And so this slide shows over the 20th century the increasing length of life at birth. And you can see in the first half of the 20th century a lot of jagged lines. That's because most of the diseases, the conditions that really affected people at that time were outbreaks, were infectious diseases, sanitation issues, so that you had lots of outbreaks. And you can certainly see in 1918 the drop in length of life. That was the flu epidemic of 1918, which is certainly a reminder to us that flu can have a huge issue. Several hundred or 33,000 people in Minnesota died during that epidemic, hundreds of thousands throughout the United States, and that's one of the concerns that we have as we move forward, that some of those infectious disease things that were infecting us in the early part of the 20th century are still around. We have them under control most times, but they're always there, so we have to be concerned with them. The latter half of the 20th century, you see the line flattening out because we have changed to a more chronic disease model in terms of what's causing us to die. And that's where it's not as jagged in terms of the ups and downs of death, but it's there. And those are the things that we can really address with good nutrition and physical activity and tobacco use cessation. And certainly as we look, you know, that pie chart that shows those determinants of health, with 30% being behaviors, 40% socioeconomic, and 10% being clinical care, it is appropriate for us to consider how we balance that. So one of my goals as health commissioner is to really argue for a good balance of investment between prevention and treatment. And right now in our healthcare system, we spend 95% of our healthcare dollar on treatment and 5% nationally on the prevention activities, despite the fact that medical care really counts for only about 10% of the overall influence on health. And in Minnesota, things are even a little bit more skewed. This chart shows where Minnesota has spent its dollars in 2012, and that the uncategorized spending of 1.5% is where public health is located. And if you look at the total dollars, it's really 0.9% of the dollars that we spend in Minnesota actually goes into public health. And Minnesota is 48th in the country in terms of per capita spending on public health. And it's those investments that are made in public health that really pay the dividends. I always argue that the health that we have today, we're the sixth healthiest state in the country, we're healthy because of the investments that were made in the 70s and the 80s about on the things that really pay, really contribute to health, the good investments, the investments that you make, and all of those conditions that concern health, you, the legislature, the investments we make in education, the investments we make in housing, the investments we make in economic development, the investments we make in all of those areas that impact health. And so, but we're trying to really integrate medical care and public health. And this is a model that we really look at in terms of how we think about that. On the far right is where our healthcare system really started to develop, where we had acute diseases, we had illnesses and injuries, so people afflicted and with complications, and that's where our hospitals and our clinicians really started to work, and that's where the medical care system still has the major role to play. But as we learn more and as we started to look at the things that influenced health, we started to realize that we could try to get people earlier on in the course of their conditions before they became symptomatic. So early intervention, early identification, the screening, all those affected people without complications, try to get them before they become sick. And that's where a lot of the primary care activities go on. still, as we learn more about people who are at risk, the vulnerable populations, the low income, the populations of color, the people without access to resources, the people who don't have a lot of community supports, those vulnerable folks who are really at risk for developing some conditions. And that's where public health has generally focused, on how to identify the at-risk folks and intervene so they don't become ill. We're saying now that, though, we have to move even further upstream, where we have to take a health and all policies approach, where we actually have to keep people from becoming vulnerable in the first place. We want them to be safe and healthy, so that if we have a healthy community, if we have healthy policies, if we have a healthy transportation system, housing system, it'll keep people safe and healthy and keep them from becoming vulnerable. And this is where a lot of our health equity work is trying to build safe and healthy communities. And just one sort of data slide that will point out the focus that we're taking on both medical care and public health. This slide shows some modeling that's been done with data in the United States about deaths prevented. The red lines, the vertical lines, are the deaths. So you want the red line to be high, and the green line or the blue line is costs, and you want that line to be low. The first two set of bars is really if everybody had access to insurance. Everything else stayed the same. You had access to insurance. You would save some lives. The red bar goes up, and it would cost a little bit more money than right now. The second bar is if you left everything the same as it is right now and just did prevention care in the clinical setting, you would save more lives, and the cost wouldn't go up as much. The third set of bars is that if you just do the public health activities, the community prevention activities, everything else stayed the same, you see, you will save some lives, but it wouldn't cost as much as the other two scenarios. But that's in 10 years. And our concern is that 25 years, though, if you model that out, the only way that you're actually going to save money is if you invest in the public health activities that actually prevent illnesses from the developing and in saving costs. That's where you really have to save the most lives and where you actually save money. But it's an investment that pays its dividends 25 years down the road. That's why I talk about the health that we have today are because of the investments that were made 25 and 30 years ago. But we're not saying that it's one or the other. We believe that you should have access to health insurance. There should be prevention in the clinical setting, and you should do the public health activities. And this is just one slide that shows if you do all three. The green line is if you do all three of those things in terms of costs. Yes, implementing some of these programs initially will increase costs, but in the long run, costs will go down. The red line is if you just did health insurance. The blue line is if you did health insurance and the prevention care. You can see the costs go up for both of those. The only way you get costs down is if you actually add the prevention aspects to this, the public health prevention. So that's sort of the background. That's the philosophy. So that's the context that we bring to our work at the Minnesota Department of Health. And so I'm going to go through now some of the various programs of the department so you can see how they fit into that philosophy. Our mission to protect and maintain and improve the health of all Minnesotans. We really take a population-based approach. We deal with both numerators and denominators, but the denominators are really important. And we're one of the five state health departments in the country, the first five to be accredited. So we really are proud of what we do. And one of the things I certainly have recognized as being health commissioner, that we have a dedicated staff who are mission-driven and expert in what they do. And so it's really a pleasure for me to be commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. And we achieve this mission by requiring certain actions of people. That's sort of our regulatory role. We also work in partnerships with many people in the private and public sector in creating those conditions in which people can be healthy. And then we also work with individuals, encouraging them to take behaviors, improve behaviors in nutrition and physical activity and substance use. Those are the mechanisms that we take. We do this throughout the state. We have eight regional offices, district offices throughout the state, because one of our big partners is local public health. And Minnesota really has been fortunate by investing in local public health. The Community Health Services Act of 1978 took the hundreds of local boards of health and really consolidated them into 52 community health boards, where they have local control, really improving the quality and the focus of local public health. Working with us in concert with the State Health Department and local public health, really have a model that is a model for the rest of the country. We always look at public health as an enterprise. We need the federal government role to play as our federal partner. We need state health departments, and we need local public health departments. And so that has been one of my priorities, is to strengthen that bond. Some of the things that we do, certainly ones that you're probably most aware of, are our work around infectious diseases. We do 24/7, 365 monitoring of infectious diseases. Certainly it's played out a lot in our recent work with Ebola, which we're continuing to monitor about 50 patients a day who've just traveled back from West Africa. It takes a lot of effort, and it is certainly one of those areas where we have had, again, been a model for the country. We have a lab that works.
Excuse me, Commissioner Ellinger, I'm sorry. Representative Murphy, did you have a question for the commissioner?
Thanks, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I was looking at that packet, and I was really grateful to get the information ahead of time. Thank you, and thank you to Holly. I wanted to just check in with you a little bit about the infectious disease information and to talk a little bit about Ebola. And by way of introduction, I want to tell you that I practiced nursing. I was in school, actually, at the start of the AIDS epidemic, and practiced nursing in the early implementation of universal precautions, and know well from my practice about infectious disease. And so when the Department of Health and the administration started doing some work on Ebola, it was happening at the same time as I think Minnesotans and Americans across the country were worried about what that epidemic, what that disease looked like, what it meant for us. And so I'm wondering if you could just spend just a little bit of time talking about what the department did in preparation for that.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we've actually been preparing for something like Ebola since 2001. After 9/11, with some federal funding, we developed emergency preparedness, and we've been working with our partners in the healthcare system and in public health and emergency response. So we've been practicing for things like this. We certainly are always aware of pandemic flu or other infectious diseases. And in fact, in March of last year, we had a case of Lassa fever that came into Minnesota. Lassa fever is a hemorrhagic fever like Ebola. Went to Mercy Hospital, and it was handled very well because of all of the activities that we had been practicing. When we started recognizing that West Africa had an outbreak of Ebola that was unprecedented, we certainly sprang into action with all of our partners, with continual education, with the hospitals, with clinics, with the providers, with the physicians, with the nurses, with the emergency preparedness folks, the EMS system, and certainly working with the Liberian community, since the Liberian community in Minnesota is the largest outside of Liberia in the country. We did a lot of education with that. We worked with our federal partners to make sure that we had access to personal protective equipment, knowing that there was going to be a shortage, so really worked on how to obtain that, checked our stockpiles for PPE, and then worked with educating folks about how to use DOF and DON, DON and DOF, the emergency or the personal protective equipment, and then certainly worked with our federal partners on the monitoring that was coming in from the various countries through the various airports, worked very closely with the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport, with the quarantine station there where CDC has a epidemiologist working there. So there were multiple things. We've had probably 30 staff working on a full-time basis on Ebola for the last several months, educating, monitoring, doing lab testing. We're one of the 5 or 15 labs in the country that could actually do the Ebola test in rapid turnaround. So the preparation that we had been doing for the last 10, 15 years has really paid off for us being ready to accomplish that. And I also have to say that I'm really pleased with the healthcare community coming forward, the hospital association in coming forward with identifying 4 hospitals that would step forward to be treatment hospitals for anybody who may have Ebola. Also, all of the training that the hospitals did and the clinicians did in terms of how to deal with these infectious diseases. It was a good community effort.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Given that the health department has its expertise, of course, in infectious disease and epidemiology, can you just drill down a little bit more about what the department had to do specifically with regard to Ebola that was different than the line work that you're generally doing about potential disease outbreaks, about infectious disease, and why there was such a specialized and intense effort around this condition this fall.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. Well, certainly Ebola is a unique virus. It generated a lot of attention and a lot of fear. So we had to, and because of the way it was transmitted and because of what we saw happening in Texas, people were really frightened at what they were seeing, and we recognized that we had to take every precaution and not fail, you know, make sure that we're 100% as best we could appropriate in what we were doing. So the educating of the staff was in hospitals, or anybody who would deal with a person under investigation, was really important, which is more intense than we've done in the past. The monitoring, to make sure that we would follow every patient who had been at risk, so that we have 24/7 monitoring of these individuals on a daily basis with either direct contact or phone contact, that we had to develop the lab techniques in order to do the lab testing, but also to transport the specimens to the health department, make sure that if we had to transport a patient, everybody along the way knew how to handle that patient in a safe and effective manner. So these were things that were above and beyond what we would normally do. There's some of the same things that we do, but the intensity of this was so great, and the turnaround and the anxiety level was so intense that we really were under a lot of pressure to do it right the very first time.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then that's the same for my last question. The issue of Ebola, and you mentioned the fear, in the fall, as I was out talking with Minnesotans, the idea of this unknown disease was percolating a little bit in the minds of Minnesotans, and that was fostered a little bit by some newspaper ads, et cetera, that were run in the fall. And I recall worrying, especially having practiced during the start or the onset of the AIDS epidemic, I was really worried that Minnesotans would be concerned and maybe not clear about our preparation, and so was really happy to know that you and the administration had done so much work along with the hospital community and the provider community, and I really do want to give a shout out to the healthcare community for the work to be able to prepare in the event that we had an episode or somebody in Minnesota that contracted the virus. And I understand that that work that you did incurred some cost to the Department of Health. Is that accurate?
That is correct.
And is that, I understand, a cost that we need to account for early in the session in order to make sure that the Department of Health is continuing to do its work. Is that correct?
And Commissioner Ellinger, and just really briefly to that point, I understand in talking with Representative Dean, too, that we will be hearing bills and discussing some of the deficiency bills and issues related to some of these costs, where we'll have the chance to dive into this issue much more in depth. So to what extent you want to comment, Commissioner Ellinger, and then we'll probably need to keep moving forward, knowing that we'll have a lot more time for this going forward.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And with that, then, I will just say that I want to thank the Department of Health Administration for all the work that you did. I think that it's really important that you paid attention not only to the potential of someone contracting or bringing that condition to Minnesota, but also to the fear that Minnesotans were expressing, especially because it became a little bit a source of hype. There was some hyperbole added to this, and I hope that we work quickly here in the Minnesota House to fund that deficiency. I think it should be a real important priority for this committee and then for the Minnesota House. And with that, I'll let that go for now. And I'm grateful that we'll talk about it some more in a while. Thanks.
And Representative Lane, did you have a brief question?
I just wanted to follow up on that briefly, that I really, really value our Minnesota Department of Health, and I think we're epidemiology leaders in the nation. And so I would tell people that Ebola is not going to happen in America because we're going to stop it before it can start. And now I hear the background of how we did that. And when you tell me 30 staff were on it and 24/7 monitoring, I know some of the details now of how you did that, but I do want to pay attention to the costs behind that.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, Representative Murphy, thank you for bringing up those issues. This is a good example, I think, of what's unique about Minnesota. The partnerships between public health and clinical care, between the hospitals and the providers and public health, is really quite, really remarkable in that we've all come together and we've practiced this over the years. I also think it also highlights the fact that, and you'll see later on in our slides, that most of our dollars, particularly most of our dollars around infectious disease, come from the federal government. We've leveraged a lot of resources from the federal government, so a lot of our activities are funded by the federal government. And when those dollars go down, we don't have much flexibility. So we've had to shift resources into Ebola because we had no funding for Ebola. So, you know, we expect that we will probably spend over $1 million on dealing with Ebola that we had not planned in our budget. Shifting resources from one place to another, but there are federal dollars that have really specific requirements, so we're going to have to pay those back in some way, shape, or form. So it just highlights the fact that we do need to have a partnership between the feds and the state and locals in order to deal with some of these issues that affect all of us, and Ebola was a good example of that. I know I've only got only about 5 minutes left on this half-hour time period, so I will go as rapidly as I possibly can and not go into some of the examples. But certainly, epidemiology is one of those things. We've been a leader in identifying diseases, especially the novel illnesses. We look for unexplained deaths, trying to see if there's some infectious disease that might be causing it. And we've identified some novel infections that nobody else has seen, particularly people in the slaughterhouses in southern Minnesota, where they're having a neurological condition. By the way, they were handling the pig brains. Our staff were the ones that were able to identify that, get that out, and it changed the procedures in slaughterhouses throughout the country to be able to do that. You know, and our response to emergencies has really been quite remarkable. Environmental health, we're really responsible for protecting people from the environment. The Pollution Control Agency protects the environment from people. We do just the opposite. We protect people from the environment, and we really want to make sure that the water that people are drinking, the wells that we have, this is one of the resources in our state that is protected and safe to drink. Certainly the food that we eat, we want to make sure it's safe. And again, we have identified outbreaks in food that have really changed practices throughout the country. We are certainly one of the great partners that the Centers for Disease Control has in identifying foodborne outbreaks. And we really work at reducing risks on a whole variety of areas that in terms of chemicals within water, chemicals with the environment, responding to disasters, floods, mold that occurs in houses after floods, which we've seen a lot of in the last several years. You know, that's where we really come forward with a lot of our environmental health activities. Similarly, as I mentioned, our emergency preparedness, we've been planning, we practice on a regular basis with our healthcare systems, with our hospitals, with our providers, responding to public health emergencies wherever they happen. One of the areas, switching gears, another area that we've just gotten engaged with that you were involved with is the Office of Medical Cannabis. You know, we are in the process of standing up that program to treat. We anticipate about 5,000 individuals with 9 different conditions with high-quality medical cannabis. And we have 2 distributors, growers, who are working with our department to develop their plans. So we will be coming back to you, I'm sure, as we identify new conditions as outlined in the legislative piece, or the bills that came through that we're working under. So I'm anticipating that we're going to have the best medical cannabis program in the country, and that's our goal, to implement it in a really high-quality way. We also work really with on a whole variety of areas in terms of rural health, because we know that access is an issue in rural communities. Healthcare providers are limited in rural communities, so we do a lot of work with our rural Minnesotans in improving access to care, improving the healthcare workforce, And we work a lot with nursing homes, hospitals, and other care facilities to make sure that the care that is being provided is high quality and safe for all of the individuals in those institutions. We also have a health economics program that really does monitor what's going on in our healthcare system in terms of quality and cost. We have a state quality measurement system that we use that information, the all-payer claims database, to look at quality and cost. And see, you can see on this chart that we've been monitoring the healthcare costs, the red line. They've been increasing much faster than inflation and much faster than the rest of the Minnesota economy. And so I use this argument is that if we're going to bend that curve, we're going to have to do things differently. We're not going to be able to treat ourselves into good health. We're not going to be able to treat ourselves into lower cost care. We need a high-quality medical care system, which I believe Minnesota, I personally believe that we have the best medical care system in the country. It's the most efficient, most cost-effective, but without a collaborative public health approach, we're never going to be able to bend the cost curve. And I think this slide shows that we need to do a balance of prevention and treatment. We also, in our health reform work, with the Department of Human Services, have developed healthcare homes, which really focus on care coordination, multidisciplinary approach to care, really coordinated care within the resources within the context of community, incentive payments based on value rather than just fee for service, and again measuring the quality of that. We have a grant, the statewide state innovation model. We're developing accountable communities for health, which is really looking at how we engage the clinical care system with the public health system, with the human service system, with the long-term care and behavioral health systems in communities throughout the state to see how an integrated system can really do that balance that is necessary to really create health. We also certainly deal with a lot of chronic diseases. We are in the age where chronic diseases are killing more people than acute infectious diseases or injuries. And the major determinants of that are tobacco, diet, physical inactivity, and alcohol. They account for over 80% of the chronic diseases. And we deal with those chronic diseases certainly with our disease prevention and control unit, health promotion and chronic disease program, dealing with providers, dealing with patients, dealing with systems on how to do case management, how to do prevention. But we also deal with our local communities through the statewide health improvement program, which is a really effective way of dealing with chronic diseases by actually moving upstream, by looking at policies, systems, and environmental change at the local level that can reduce the chronic disease burden within communities. And I really like the SHIP program because it is a collaborative at the local level of businesses, of schools, the communities, of healthcare, of public health, working collaboratively at the local level, implementing evidence-based practices at the local level. And in your packet, I have three slides that I won't go through that highlight some of the activities that are going on throughout in SHIP and in various areas. But one, I go around the state pitching horseshoes with county commissioners and hospital administrators and public health folks, and I was up in Alexandria and saw their complete streets and how their complete streets development really added to the physical activity. It linked to a DNR trail, which was just outside of town, brought more bikers into town, and it was a community, it was an economic development tool, it was a physical activity tool, it was a disease prevention tool, and it was a leveraging of other local resources. That's the kind of thing that SHIP does throughout the state. We also do a lot of preventive services, particularly in community and family health, immunizations. Part of the health that we have is because we have a highly immunized population, and this is an ongoing thing with the changing makeup of our state in terms of the demography of it. We need to continue to educate populations about the importance of immunizations and make those immunization services available. The WIC program, the Supplemental Food Program for Women, Infants, and Children, one of the largest programs that we have, actually provides nutritious food to pregnant women, pregnant and breastfeeding women, and children up to age 5, really has helped to lower infant mortality, has helped to increase birth weights, and has helped to improve child development. And as you're well aware, we're an increasingly diverse state, and one of those things that the World Health Organization identified, if you're going to be healthy, is equity. And as we see our state becoming much more diverse, when I moved here in 1980, we were 2% people of color in American Indians. We're now 17% statewide, 24% in the metropolitan area, and statewide second graders, 34% of all second graders are kids of color or American Indians. So we're becoming increasingly diverse, but we're also seeing that the diversity is highlighting some of the disparities that we have. And if we're going to be a healthy state, we're going to have to deal with those disparities. I say it's simply a social justice problem, but it's also a math problem. If we don't deal with the disparities and our population becomes increasingly diverse, we're not going to be able to maintain that high state health ranking that we have. And so we've been putting a lot of effort on advancing health equity as part of our activities. We did a report to the legislature last February about the needs for advancing health equity. Has generated a lot of interest throughout the state, a lot of collaboration, and we've embedded this in all parts of our department so that all of our activities are having a focus on doing a good job, but having the lens of what is this going to do for equity in our state. And that has really helped us modify some of our funding activities, certainly our hiring activities and grant-making activities. It is really impacting what we do throughout the department. And lastly, of the things that we do, data are the business of public health, and we really, that's our currency. And so birth and death records are what we do for the state, and we've certainly been working much more effectively to get, we do like 750,000 transactions through the vital records system every year in Minnesota, and we've been able to modify those so we can get people copies of their records within 24 hours. And also we work on the birth side, but also on the death side, making sure that people get buried and everyone is safe. We have a biennial budget of $1.059 billion. 44% of that is federal. That's sort of an undercounting because many of the other areas like TANF and the special revenue and MERC are also partially federally funded. So over half of our overall dollars are federal dollars. We only have 14% of our budget is general fund dollars. And this is how we spend the general fund dollars. Most of it is for grants, 19% for payroll, rent, and other services. Our staffing right now is 1,300 FTEs. That's been steadily going down over the last 7 to 10 years. The general funded FTEs are 128. Just as I'll close by showing, just as I mentioned, the point, the fact that we are federally funded, some of our programs are significantly dependent on federal funds. The WIC is a federal funded. It's the largest program that we have through the Department of Agriculture. Our next level of funding comes from the Centers for Disease Control, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, HRSA, and on it, all of these are the various funding sources that we have. Our staff have been very good at getting federal grants. The feds like us. They like what we do. We put the money to good use, but that's a double-edged sword. Our Office of Emergency Preparedness is 98% federally funded. Infectious Disease, Epidemiology, Prevention, Control, IDEPC, as we call it, 85% federally funded. So that when we get something like Ebola, that really stresses those dollars because we don't have any flexibility in those dollars. Community and family health, the services that we do for home visiting and maternal and child health are 81% federally funded. So as I said, public health is what we do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. Our job as a health department is to identify issues, identify the conditions that are not being supportive of health, and then work with our partners, our local partners, our legislative partners, our private sector partners, to really try to work on those conditions. I'm certainly working with the other cabinet members in transportation and housing and certainly human services and education to say we're all in this together, that all of the issues that we bring forward to the legislature have health components to that. So we're here to help with those conversations, with the data, and certainly working in collaboration with you, the policymakers, and our other partners to make Minnesota the healthiest state possible. So with that, opened up to any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Commissioner Ellinger, and appreciate it. I know it's a tall task asking you to cover all that the department does in this short period of time, but the goal was a high-level overview just to let everybody kind of know what they're responsible for, and I know that you did hand out some handouts in your paper with kind of a bullet point of all the things that you guys do, as well as some articles, just to draw members' attention to that. And so we'll take a couple of brief questions from members, and then as we close, Commissioner Ellinger, if there's anyone that you want to point out that's here, just to put faces with names in terms of people that we will have to reach out to with questions and liaisons to the legislature, that will be helpful. So we'll first take a couple questions. Representative Freiberg.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Mack. First of all, thank you, Dr. Ellinger, for your presentation. It's great to see the department's focus on public health because it is a critical issue. There wasn't a slide on this topic, but I did notice the handout related to the use of e-cigarettes and the alarming increase in use rates among teens of e-cigarettes. I know it's been illegal in the state for a few years for minors to use or possess or purchase e-cigarettes, but only last year did we actually add it to the system where cities and counties in Minnesota are required to license the sale of all tobacco products now, including e-cigarettes, and conduct compliance checks. I'm just wondering if you know if, you know, since this is here, since it does seem like there's an alarming increase in youth rates of e-cigarettes, if there have been more issues with them as far as youth purchasing them or illegally acquiring them relative to more traditional tobacco products.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg. Certainly e-cigarettes are a concern, particularly use among young adults and adolescents. Adolescents in particular, the use of e-cigarettes now outstrips the use of tobacco among adolescents. And the e-cigarette companies are actually targeting young individuals for that. The marketing using cartoon characters, flavorings that really appeal to young folks. And we now see that among adolescents who are using e-cigarettes, 25% have never smoked cigarettes. So they're not using e-cigarettes to stop smoking tobacco. So we're concerned, as a pediatrician, I'm concerned about the fact that nicotine, its effect on the developing brain. So anything that we can do to reduce the use of or eliminate the use of e-cigarettes, which provides nicotine to the individual, it's an addictive subject. If we can reduce that, eliminate that, that would really be helpful for the long-term health. I know a lot of local communities are working on that issue. The legislature worked on it last year and passed some legislation to put some restrictions on that. But it certainly is a concern because the rate of uptake of e-cigarettes is really dramatic.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Commissioner, Madam Chair. You speak so fast. You said within the same disease I have, I speak fast too. But you mentioned the percent that we spend on public health of all health care spending was 0.09% or 0.9%. Can you clarify that?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I will try to speak more slowly. It was 0.9%. The state funding for public health.
Of all health care spending, of state health. Funding, does not include federal funding, that's just correct. State funding.
State.
Commissioner Ellinger. Representative Schultz.
When you're talking about federal funding, how much federal funding would we lose if we reduced or eliminated state funding for some health programs or health spending?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure that I can answer that question. Dave?
Representative Schultz, are you asking about, like, matching federal dollars?
Sure. Yeah, matching funds, or we may not be quite matching, but I know we get a lot of federal funds, and we would lose a significant portion if we reduced or eliminated state funding for some programs.
If you could introduce yourself for the record, and there's probably a lot of detail to this question, so if you could just give a high level and then maybe follow up offline, and then we can continue to move forward.
Certainly, Madam Chair, Representative. Dave Freeman with the Department of Health. I'm the Budget Director. It really depends on which program we're talking about. In a number of programs, our state funding represents a federal match, or a match to the federal funds that we receive. So, in some cases, when we receive things like we receive Medicaid dollars or Medicare dollars for some of the work we do on compliance monitoring with nursing home surveys, that's a fairly significant amount of our budget. Other programs where we receive federal dollars are maybe competitive grants where there's not as much federal funding at stake if we cut state funding, but it's really dependent on the type of program we're talking about. But we'd be happy to provide some more information about that.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Thank you for coming to the committee, and welcome back to all of the advocacy folks and agency representatives and government relations specialists. So welcome back to the committee this year, and I look forward to a good year. Commissioner, could you just give us a really quick update on how we're doing with the flu, vaccines, and numbers real quick? Thanks.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are seeing flu is particularly severe this year because of the strain that we're having, the H3N2 strain, which when that becomes the predominant organism, it is usually a severe case. We've also discovered or also saw that this year that the peak of activity was earlier in the year than usual. It really, we're hoping that it peaked in December, that we don't have another peak. It appears to be declining in intensity at this point in time. We're concerned that there might be another peak later on of a different strain, but we'll just have to monitor that on an ongoing basis. The hospitals have been, and emergency rooms have been quite busy with influenza. Certainly outbreaks in schools have been throughout the state. We've had deaths. We've had 4 pediatric deaths. Those are the ones that we monitor, pediatric deaths. And these are, it's not the highest we've ever had, but this year is one of those more severe years for influenza. The flu vaccine, there's plenty of flu vaccine available. It, as you've heard, it is not a perfect match for the strains that are out there, but there is some cross-reactivity, and so that there is definitely some benefit from getting the flu shot. Even now, if you've not had a flu shot, people should get the flu shot because there are other strains that could be circulating, and we could have another peak during the course of this flu season.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And I think we will wrap up with a question from Representative Mulry.
Thank you. I've talked to some health professors, public health professors from some major universities around the country, and they're telling me that in your role of prevention, that the EPA standards are really extremely low, and or I guess the opposite, they're too high. And they have suggested that departments of health it's harder for PCA to get around the EPA standards. For instance, one of the big areas now is PMs and some of the other elements other than the ones that the EPA regulates. They've suggested that health departments aren't bound by the Commerce Clause in any way and would have more rights to do that. What do you think about that? Has your department looked into that at all, or is that on the table at all?
Commissioner Ellinger, and if you could, just for the members of the committee, there are a lot of acronyms used there. If you could just expound on that so everybody knows what we're talking about, that would be helpful. Thank you, Commissioner
Ellinger. Madam Chair, Representative, there are a lot of chemicals that are in our environment. As we monitor the research that's going on throughout the country on various chemicals, and we look at health limits and the impact on health. And we do have a part of our environmental health program that looks at setting limits on a whole variety of things when the data are support us being able to do that. It is science-based. We certainly work a lot with the universities in doing that. So we have some of the ability and have done that for some water quality issues in particular where we've set some limits that are more stringent than what EPA has done because it's based on new and evolving data that we have either collected or other researchers have collected.
Representative Mulry?
Just so my understanding from your answer is that you go beyond what probably the PCA could do on its own. And I think that's great.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative, my belief is that we have done that and are able to do that at the levels below what EPA can do first when it's science-based.
Okay, and with that, Commissioner Ellinger, if there's anyone that you want to just point out so people recognize the face and put a name with the face in terms of some of the folks from the department that we'll be seeing around here, it might be available for us to reach out to with questions, concerns, follow-up.
Madam Chair, thank you for that opportunity. Dan Pollack is my deputy commissioner, and I think you probably know him from previous activities, and he certainly will been a great addition to our department. Melissa Finnegan is our legislative director. Jean Ayers is our assistant commissioner for Health Improvement Bureau. Manny Munson-Regala, our assistant commissioner for our Health Systems Bureau. Dave Greenman, who you met as our budget director. Jackie Cavanaugh in our legislative office. Oh, and Chris Bruski, Chris, raise your hand, in our Health Protection Bureau, and Lee Ho in our Health Operations Bureau. Anybody else? Chris Ayersman is our Director of Infectious Diseases and IDEPC, Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control, our Ebola expert.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for being here. Really appreciate it. I am sure everybody on the committee has that memorized and committed to memory, so we're all set. I know, and for members of the committee, these guys are huge resources and tend to show their faces around here quite a bit, and so definitely use them. They are a wealth of knowledge. So thank you, Commissioner Ellinger, very much for the presentation, and I am sure we'll be in touch very soon.
Thank you all.
And with that, if we want to bring Commissioner of DHS forward, Commissioner Jessen. And thank you so much for coming, Commissioner. If you want to introduce yourself for the record and go on with your proceedings, that would be great.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I'm Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and it's really great to be here with you and kick off this legislative session. So I'm just going to dive in, if that's okay, Madam Chair. Obviously happy to take questions. First of all, I wanted to thank you for giving me the opportunity to give you a pretty high-level view of the Department of Human Services so that you at least understand, for those of you who aren't as familiar with this, what the structure is, how we're organized, and what parts of the department do what. And I'm hoping, because I know some of you are already experts in areas that deal with our department deals with, but I'm hoping that some of you all listen to this presentation and think, I would like to learn more about, maybe it's child support, maybe it's our chemical health system. And I just wanted to let you know, please reach out to us because we can come and have some experts come and brief you and give you some background if you're really looking at how can you dive in, learn more, take these areas on. So please, I hope you'll all take us up on it. I know a number of you have in the past. So it's actually with a lot of humility that I'm here talking on behalf of the whole human services work that we do in our state because we work with so many others. We are, as all of you all, I think, know, a state-supervised but county-administered system, and we work and rely so much on the great work that the counties and our tribal partners do to work with us. But we also rely, and if you look at some of the numbers I'll show you about grants and other things with a number of, with others as well, outside of the government, of just great nonprofit and some for-profit providers in our state. We work closely with the health plans in a lot of our work. So we really depend so much on the work of others. I did want to just start out by saying, too, we are starting a new human services performance management system. system that were just rolled out and started in 2014, where we're looking at the work across all the counties and agreeing, working with the counties to say, what are the outcomes that we think are most important? And then we'll have kind of by county how those counties are doing and some thresholds for performance. We're starting with the children's area and adult services, but I think that will be a good way to keep everybody up to date on how everyone's doing and to make sure that we continue to improve. So you can look forward to more. I have to start out any of this by saying we are so lucky to live in Minnesota and that we rank high when you're looking at the work we do in health and human services. Now, Commissioner Ellinger just said that we're the sixth healthiest state, so a new ranking must have come out. Last I looked, we were third. But I also know that there was actually even a new ranking that looked at the rankings for the best health care system in the country by the Commonwealth Fund, and Minnesota is ranked number one. Number one for long-term care, home, and community-based services, the healthiest state for seniors, overall health care system for low-income populations. So that's not just health care, but that's all the work that we really do to help the most vulnerable and to provide that safety net. We're number four in the country. So while there's much to do, I just think we all have to have much to be proud of as well. So the department, I think you all know what we do, is really talking about providing essential services to the most vulnerable Minnesotans. And wherever we can to offer really that ladder out of poverty as well. And while I go through some numbers, I mean, overall we serve far in excess of 1 million Minnesotans every year. And when you think about our state, you know, 5.3 million Minnesotans, our programs touch so many in our state. We are, at DHS, the state's largest agency. We have more than 6,300 employees at 200 sites all over the state. And so in DHS jargon, we have what we call administrations, and I'm going to kind of go through what the different administrations do. I think they call them bureaus of the Department of Health, but they're listed here. And I'll be talking a little bit more about each of them after talking about kind of the high level things we do at DHS. And at the end, I'm going to highlight a couple of challenges that I think we face as a state in the human services area. So who do we serve? Well, we serve a lot of people, but these are the three biggest groups of folks. Children, we have more than 420,000 children who get health care through the department, as well as, you know, 31,000 that get child care. We pay for health care for over 68,000 Minnesota seniors. We also do a lot more to support seniors across our state beyond just health care through our Board of Aging. And other work I'll describe. And we do spend much of our time, effort, money, and working with people with disabilities so that they can live as independently as possible. We currently serve over 130,000 people with disabilities. And once again, this is not just health care. This is about employment. This is about housing. These are just some of the numbers. And I will skip through some of the number slides, you know, but at least they're a reference. But I think this gives you a sense of how many people are on our Medicaid program every month. These are our 2015 projections, but that's over a million. Medicaid, as you all know, most of you, is called medical assistance in Minnesota. But some of these other numbers aren't as well known. The fact that we do over 300,000 background studies, you know, not just for programs across the state every year. We have over 500,000 people on our SNAP program. We put together a framework for the future. We were looking at, shortly after I started as commissioner, to think of how do we try and have one place, because the department is vast and does so much working with others. And so we tried to say, well, let's try and have one page where everyone can look at and say, these are the main things we're going to work on in this year. So I included that in your handouts. It's called the Framework for the Future. And we have the mission and the values on there, and those mission and values haven't changed for years and years and years and years. But we also try and say, okay, what are the big things we're working on? And you'll see this. This is for 2014. We're coming out just in the next week or so with our 2015 version. But if you go onto our website, you'll see we have a public dashboard, and you can go and say, okay, how are they doing on this? How are they tracking? So I thought it was a way to really engage our employees, but also just to be more accountable to the public about the main things that we're working on at DHS. Spending. So this is 2013 all fund spending, over $12 billion a year. And you'll see that most of that is for forecasted programs. And those forecasted programs, over 8 billion of that is for our medical assistance program. And where does that money go? And I thought this is one you might want to take a little time and look at. Because some people think of, well, DHS, it's the, you know, it's the welfare program agency. But if you think that most of what we spend, the vast majority is on health care and a lot on long-term care. Where you see the part that says forecasted programs, economic assistance, you know, that a large part of that is our MFIP, our welfare to work program. But that is just a small part of the dollars that we spend. State-operated services, if I could point that out too, Social Security Hospital, ANOCA, our mental health system, the group homes that we have around the state, while that's over half of our employees, it's 1.6% of our budget. So just to try and add some perspective there. Medical assistance is the large driver as far as dollars. As I said before, $8.3 billion. And I just thought it would be good to kind of get the split on what's kind of in our basic care, which includes this, an amount for mental health services, but also the $3.4 billion we spend in long-term care, either facilities or in what we call waivers. And you'll learn more about this if you're not already kind of in the HHS world, but we have a number of programs we call waiver programs that serve the people with developmental disabilities. We have a CADI waiver, traumatic brain waiver, elderly waiver. But these are basically a way to get to, for people who otherwise, you know, 10, 15 years ago would have been an institution. But we can provide them the services through these programs to stay in the community. I think we can. Oh, this one I think is important just for some context as well. The first side looks at who are our monthly enrollees. Who are the people who are on our medical assistance program that's spending all this money? And you'll see that most of the people are children and family and adults without children. So it's the 183,000 that are the elderly and disabled. But if you look at the next pie chart, you'll see our total expenditures. And you see that the more than half of those expenditures are for the elderly and disabled. This includes our long-term care spending. So when we talk about health care, just think it's good to think about how important and critical long-term care is as part of that. Okay, Commissioner Ellinger, he stole my slide on this. Well, actually, I think I used the Department of Health slide on this. Just to talk about, well, if we're talking about health, it's not just our health care system, right? And he talked to you all about that, so I'm not going to go through that. But one of the things that made us think about at DHS is we have to do a better job connecting people in our programs who may be in our health care program, but really what may help them the most is making sure they sign up for SNAP so they have food. Or they're able to, you know, to get into to a job or get that child care help. And so we need to do a better job working across our department. We also need to do a better job working with our providers to treat the whole person. So right now we have a lot of silos. And, you know, most people with the most complex needs or the biggest needs, they don't fall on just one of these. You know, they have a number of them. And we need to be much more coordinated. So we've started to efforts to do that, including what we call our IHPs, our Integrated Health Partnerships. We're working with providers to say, let's define a community of people on our programs and work with you to take care of those people and keep them healthy and change the financial incentives so that there is a way that they can get more money if they do that. And then the incentives are to do some of what Commissioner Ellinger was talking about. Well, let's do more prevention. Let's try and deal with more of these things up front. So we're trying to, using our role as a major payer in the healthcare system, to try and drive some of that change as well. So at this part, I'm just going to go through some of the, at very high level, our administrations and let you know what they do. Obviously, a ton more detail, but I did want to leave some time for questions. So our healthcare administration, we have almost 700 FTEs in our healthcare administration. Assistant Commissioner Nathan Morocco, who I know is here today, is the Assistant Commissioner for this area. And this area does a lot of heavy lifting. If you think of all those people who are on our medical assistance program, and there are even more when you think about our Minnesota Care program, we do a lot just to have the trains run on time or as best we can. So we have eligibility operations. We address access. We work with members. We have a member help desk, a provider hotline. We We have a Medicaid director who really works across the agency and does a lot of work with CMS, so we make sure we're meeting their rules and I'm working them where we can. We do research and measure the quality of our providers because that's very important to us. And we are trying, like in that purchasing and delivery, service delivery, to try and do more to change the way we purchase services to drive a harder bargain, but get better value too. Who we serve, the people, well, they're the Minnesotans that are enrolled in our healthcare programs. And we think of it also very closely working with the providers who serve our clients. So it's some of it is not glamorous. We have just amazing number of hardworking people that process applications, make eligibility determinations, coordinate the purchasing and delivery of services, who are answering those phones, who are paying those claims. I would say, especially in this part of the department as well, we are heavily, as we are really throughout the department, heavily reliant upon IT systems. And I'll talk about that as one of our challenges. Serve a million people on our medical assistance program, in a month without making sure an IT system that's worked. But if you think about it, it's also for child support. We have a separate system for that. But when you're serving these numbers of people, we have to work closely with our colleagues at Minute and just spend a lot of time trying to make those systems work. So the healthcare administration, not including our medical assistance spending, this kind of gives you a sense of what we do otherwise, especially in our grant programs. Continuing care, we're in the middle of a naming debate at the department, so I'm going to give you some caveats. So we actually created a new area to focus just on aging services, and I'm going to talk about that, and then we have a new administration that we're going to kind of combine that I'll describe in a bit that we're actually hope to announce a new name in the next week. But our continuing care, our aging area, we have 118 employees here. Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman, who many of you all who've been around to know a lot, who served a number of administrations. And this is really the area where we work with the Board of Aging, provide support to them, do a lot of our aging and adult services, and really do work very closely with nursing homes across the state. We serve older Minnesotans with a variety of needs. And we serve a lot of people, older Minnesotans, that aren't just on public programs. I mean, a lot of the work that we do is really trying to reach out and help older Minnesotans so they can be as independent and stay in their homes and communities as much as possible, engaged. After all, we are the state that's number one for seniors, right? And we have a great number of seniors that volunteer and are active. And if we promote that, it's also in our economic best interest because they're less likely to ending up in a long-term care facility and on our Medicaid program. So I think this just kind of reiterates that. We also oversee the state's adult protective services programs. As more people as we're living longer, and that's a great thing in Minnesota that we're living longer, it's really, I think, more important that we upgrade our adult service protections services, and we're working closely with the counties to do that. But I put this number here, and this kind of is a preview to my challenges, because this shows you the number of elderly that are served in our medical assistance or Medicaid program today. So you can see just the increase between 2010 and 2020, and with the age wave, how that's going to go up. We project that's going up. Clearly one of the challenges that we face. And spending in this area, outside of medical assistance, which of course is the big driver, these are some of the we have grant programs with some administration and some other ones as well. So this area is actually a new administration where we are combining our chemical and mental health divisions, our disability services division, and our deaf and hard of hearing services division. We have a naming contest, and we'll know the name soon. Community is a big favorite, whether it's community living, community supports and services, but that's a theme. These are people who, some of the people that we serve in these divisions, in other years might not be in the community, but today they almost all are. And we need kind of the supports to help keep them there, and that's employment, that's housing, that's support for recovery. So that is really kind of some of the themes of this administration. So we have 270 employees, FTEs at least, serving in this administration, and a new assistant commissioner, Jennifer DeCabilius, who joins us from Hennepin County, who's been just a great leader in Hennepin. And this lists kind of the different divisions that are part of this administration. So who we serve is really are those children and adults that are living with mental illness and their families, people with disabilities, people living with substance use disorders. And we know that there are a lot of people who are, and a lot of them aren't getting the treatment and support and recovery that they need. We work a lot with providers here, and we just have some excellent providers on all of these areas in the state of Minnesota. And we serve the deaf and hard of hearing Minnesotans. Once again, a lot of the services we do in this area, for example, with deaf and hard of hearing, it's not just for people who are in government programs. It's really for all Minnesotans that need this help. So we do a lot working very closely with the counties to train, you know, provide guidance, try and really encourage evidence support, evidence-based practices. And I just put a couple of these numbers here about how many children and adults in Minnesota have experienced some form of mental illness or a substance use disorder. And I think that gives you a sense, because what we're trying to do in these areas isn't just focus on people in government programs, but really try and reach and do more with folks in Minnesota to help them. And this is the spending in this area outside of what's spent in medical assistance. And this is, for those of you who want to kind of dive in and learn more, we have a Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. So some county contributions, federal contributions, state contributions to try and provide a treatment for people with substance use disorders. I think this is something in the next few years we're going to want to take a look at, how to do that differently now that chemical dependency treatment is much more now an essential health benefit and included in more insurance policies. So direct care and treatment. Don't feel free just to interrupt me here. I don't want to be accused of going too quickly. I'm from the South. Usually people think I speak too slowly. Well, this is where most of our employees are, in the direct care and treatment. You know, I don't think it fully dawned on me before I took this job that actually DHS runs the largest mental health system in the state of Minnesota. But we also provide a lot of services for people with disabilities, and for people with chemical dependency issues. So Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry oversees this area, and she works closely with Assistant Commissioner Brunell Mack, who I know is here as well. And so we have several, divisions, but I think some of them you all probably know about, some from reading in the newspapers. So we have our forensic services, but that's mostly Minnesota Security Hospital, which cares for people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous. We have our NOCA, Regional Treatment Center, which serves people with mental illness, but also a number of what they call acute psychiatric hospitals, our CBHHs, so community-based 16-bed facilities. We also have our a CARE program, which provides treatment for people with chemical dependency issues. And we have some of those facilities around the state. And in direct care and treatment is also kind of the umbrella for our Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So I guess I kind of already did this slide right when I was trying to go through them, but this just provides kind of probably a better definition than I did about who we serve. Can I just say, I think one of the things that we do here, because I think this is a challenge for us at DHS, and I think for policymakers, is we need to have safety net services, but what should that safety net look like as far as these facilities? From my perspective, we need to be there to serve people that the private providers aren't willing to or don't want to or don't have the capacity to serve. And that changes over time. So I think this is something that we continue to take a look at. I think that there are people that we serve in our group homes around the state. Some of them can be served, you know, by private providers, and we're in the process of making some of that shift. On the other hand, I would say that some of the adults with mental illness with aggressive symptoms would be a group of people that is harder to get private providers to serve, and there's always going to be the need for us to do that. So I think that especially those adults who have a risk to public safety based upon their mental illness are ones that we are going to be in this business for a long time. But I think part of that evaluation we're doing at the department, and I assume you all will be looking at as well. The employees who work in this area, I say this, all of our employees do a great job, but oh my goodness, they have tough jobs. And if you are ever interested in, I know some of you have, touring some of our facilities, I think you'll see that firsthand. And when you talk to some of the clients, they do amazing work. There's a patient panel that talks to folks at Security Hospital that have been through treatment. They're on the verge of going back into the community in a safe way. And they talk about their experiences and what it meant in their life. It is really heartwarming. So what we do, I think we've covered this. We do a lot of inpatient, but also some outpatient residential services in both in these areas. And we spend about $269 million. Now, this does not include what we call our enterprise funds. So those are especially on the finance committee as you dive into this. These are the general fund dollars. We also have some kind of businesses that operate as an enterprise, and those dollars are in addition to that. Children and Family Services. Well, we have about 330 employees in this part of the agency, and we have a new assistant commissioner, Jim Koppel, who I think many of you all know from being a deputy commissioner at the Department of Health, but who has a long time past history of being an advocate for children. So we're just delighted to have Jim join the agency. So these are the divisions that are in our Children and Family Services area. And can I just say, the parts of the department where we work most closely with the counties, it's probably in our Children and Families area. And I know that this is an area that is particularly, I think, important when you talk to our county colleagues as well. So economic assistance, so that's MFIP, our welfare to work program, you know, our food support programs, child protection, which we've all been hearing a lot about. I know Representative Mullery is on that task force with me. But how can we do more to better protect children? But adoption and foster care, things that are close to my heart, I know. As commissioner, I have like almost 1,000 state wards that I'm responsible for. You know, children that are waiting for adoption mostly, their parental rights have been terminated. And that's one of the things you don't often hear as much about because it's not as big a dollar issue. But it's just so critical to what we do to get families for those kids. Child support, we serve, here's another area where we serve people who aren't just on public programs. We have, I think, over 350,000, you know, families that we provide services to every year to collect child support. Child care assistance and child care development, if you're for families that are on our MFIT program, their kids can get into child care, and we have a basic sliding fee kind of with the waiting list, another child care program as well. And as many of you all know, we're really trying to instill more quality into those programs so that those kids who are in our state-administered child care programs are really ready for kindergarten when they get there. And that's really one of the important things we're doing. And refugee resettlement, something else that, you know, you may not, it doesn't always make the headlines, but it's a really important part of the work we do in this part of the department. So I think this just lists who we serve, low-income families. One of the things that I think is with not always as well known as it should be when we think of those families who are on our MFIT program, our welfare to work program. I think we have about 90,000 people we serve on that program. 70% of them are children. So I think of that as kind of a way where we really do serve children, as well as in our kind of more things with child in front of it, child protection, child care assistance. And what we work with counties, as I said, in this area a lot, to provide these services, to oversee these services, to give guidance around these services, to make sure they're doing the best job that we can. And I put this slide up here because if we look at the Minnesotans in poverty, well, it just is a good reminder to all of us, I think, that while overall our state is doing well and we have much to be proud of, we have a lot more children living in poverty, especially in deep poverty, you know, than we did 10 years ago. And that is especially true for our youngest children. So I just wanted to highlight that. So our spending in Children and Family Services, you can come back to this. I don't know if there will be no multiple choice test on this. But I just wanted to kind of give you a sense of that. So policy and operations. We have 560 employees in this part of the department, and it's not assistant commissioner, it's actually Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson. Please don't go back and tell Chuck he's been demoted. But this is where we do a lot to support the whole agency's work, and but also where we house the Office of Inspector General. You know, after I started this job, we really brought together and tried to beef our licensing division with our background studies and with the work we do to prevent and investigate fraud. And we've really appreciate the support the legislature's given us to beef up our fraud investigations, as well as our licensing staff. So that's an important part of what we are doing out of kind of the operations area. And I know many of you know our Inspector General, Jerry Kerber, who is really doing, I think, an excellent job trying to bring focus to this area. We also have a compliance office. We have so many rules we need to follow, federal rules, state rules, and also just kind of the ethical, kind of what's the right thing to do, you know, set of policies that any large organization has. So we have really beefed up our compliance office, added more internal auditors so that we're not waiting for someone to come and say, oh, you should have done a better job here. We can catch that early ourselves. And appeals. We have a lot of human services appeals judges that hear like SNAP appeals, or someone who was found, learned they didn't qualify for medical assistance. Well, they have appeal rights, and we hear thousands and thousands of those appeals. And then there's some of the other areas. Our information technology is now kind of centered in operations under Chuck's leadership. And that, as I said, kind of those IT systems are the backbone of our system, and a backbone that needs some work. So who we serve overall in our operations area? Well, it's really support for the entire department, but especially if we think of those vulnerable adults and children in licensed settings. You know, our licensing division that goes out and really makes sure that the kids who are in our child care settings, in our, you know, in our mental health and chemical dependency, you know, treatment facilities, that, for example, that they are safe. And we handle the appeals process, and we do a lot working with compliance on the federal level to make sure this also serves as a pass-through for a lot of federal dollars as well. And I thought you might just like to see some of the numbers in the licensing area. So every year we monitor, we have 23,000 licensed providers. That includes a lot of child care providers that we license and monitor every year. And we also do a lot, we've put a real priority on investigating child care fraud and medical assistance fraud. Particularly, we've just created a new child care fraud unit. We also are putting much more of a priority on PCA fraud. We have only, PCA accounts for probably 7% of, forget the exact numbers, our overall. Reimbursed services, but we have we spend about 40% of our investigative work looking at that, because we know that that is a growing area that needs a lot more oversight. And I know there have been some questions raised about that recently, and I'm happy to talk more about that, or, you know, address people's questions individually. But this is just overall our operations spending. So I'm not listing all the challenges. There are a lot. Even though I do go back to, you know, when you look at other states, we are very blessed to be here in Minnesota, where I think we are a state that historically has done so much to protect our most vulnerable citizens, which I'm very proud. I'm very proud of the way we've worked to do that. But we have some challenges. And one of them I alluded to before, and that is the growing number of elderly and people with disabilities who are on our medical assistance program and who will be, just given the age wave. And that is really going to put pressure on our system that I think behooves us all to think about. So these are the number of elderly that we believe, if, you know, things go as they have been, will be served in our Medicaid system. And, of course, Medicaid should be, our medical assistance program absolutely should be there for those who need it. But let's do remember that an average cost of stay in a nursing home is, for a year, is $85,000. And we have a lot of individuals that haven't been planning for that, you know, or who think that Medicare is going to cover it, and we all know that it really doesn't. But given the enormous growth in our aging population and the people without resources, I think this is something, and I know that you all are going to be doing that, really merits a hard look, and we're working. This is an issue that we're giving a lot of thought to at the department as well.
If I could just interrupt you for 1 minute, Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I just thought this would be a really good time, since you were mentioning it, to just ask you to just do a little bit more on Medicare versus Medicaid, because I remember when I started working in this area, and I can't see you down there, but you know I'm here. When I first started working in Health and Human Service area, I found that very confusing because the names are so similar, and I'm just suspecting that a lot of the new members on these two committees might not understand the difference, and I think the point you're making is really an important one about the cost driver here, which is the elderly, or that's one of the cost drivers at least, and of course that's a population thing in large part, but could you just explain a little bit more the difference between Medicare and Medicaid and why most people probably think, well, elderly, as you just said, most people probably think, well, the elderly, that's Medicare, that's the feds, but in fact it isn't. For a large part of it is not. Could you just go into that a bit more?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you for that question and for reminding me to go back to that level. I really appreciate it. So Medicare is run by the federal government, and it serves some people with disabilities and the people once that they're 65. It's kind of part A and part B, hospital versus clinic. But it covers a lot of, you know, with some deductibles, and you can get into health plans for, you know, for some of this, but it covers a lot of what we would call the basic care. So if you kind of remember that slide I went to that showed kind of our healthcare spending, how much is in basic care, going to the hospital, going to the clinic, as opposed to our healthcare spending that's long-term care, which would be if you need to be in a nursing facility or you need those services to keep you in your home, whether it's those chore services or, you know, home health aids, a lot of that. So Medicare has very limited pays for very little of the long-term care. They'll pay for, and someone I'm sure will correct me if it's wrong, I think it's like 90 days after you get out of a hospital for a nursing facility to kind of recuperate, but that's it. They don't pay for the longer-term stays. They'll pay for some home health stuff, but not really the long-term help that folks need to be able to stay in their homes and communities. So Medicare, which is a great system, but doesn't have a long-term care benefit. Medicaid, but as we all know, we're all, most of us at least, you know, eligible at the right time for Medicare. Now, Medicaid is a system that is the costs are split between the federal and state government. And it is the health care system for the poor. And how much of federal match you get depends upon how wealthy your state is, frankly. But Medicaid, so it serves a different population. It serves people who are poor, generally, kind of, and it depends on the population, you know, now about 138% of poverty level, so someone who makes about $15,000 a year and less. But Medicaid also can pay for some of long-term care. Medicaid will pay, and kind of the levels depend on the population, but for the nursing facilities, for some of those home and community-based services that can keep people with disabilities and seniors in their homes. So Medicaid, it has a broader benefit set, especially for long-term care, but it only serves the poor. There's a lot of flexibility, at least some flexibility, I wish there were more sometimes, for how we design our Medicaid systems. And so each state can get the federal match if you agree. There are certain things the feds say you have to cover, and then there are optional services that states can opt into. So for Minnesota, the federal government pays a little more, very little more than 50% of our Medicaid program. But then the state pays for half of that. But what that means is that much, I think about half of the long-term care in our state is paid for through our Medicaid program. And I think that, you know, does that help answer your question, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling?
Representative Liebling. Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Justin. We do have a couple other people with questions. Representative Backer, to this point, or do you want to wait till the end of the presentation?
I have a question.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Representative Greenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation, Commissioner Justin. You know, one of the questions I think I'll have going forward is, if I'm a taxpayer and I put a dollar into the Minnesota Department of Human Services, how much of it goes towards administration versus actually to the provider? And I know that we're working with the HMOs in this area too. But when I was on the school board, one of the things, 16 years, right, Dan? That's an inside joke, I think, at this point. No, it's not. No.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, no.
It's out there now, Representative Grunhagen.
Okay. When I was on the school board, they'd give us, you know, comparative data with other school districts of similar size in terms of where we are spending our money of special ed and that. And so what happened as school board members, we were able to identify excess areas of spending comparative to other, you know, the 350 other school districts in the state. Now, sometimes there's good reason for excess spending, okay? You know, you might have circumstances that are different than another school district. But, you know, when I look at this, I don't see, unless I'm missing it, I did see on page 10, $679 million for administrative costs. But I don't see comparative data with other states in terms of administration cost. And I got to believe there's data out there like that. And are we administering these programs as effectively as other states? We probably are. We do a good job on our health care. And, you know, are there things other states are doing in terms of reforms? And I know there's Medicaid reforms going on in Arkansas, Tennessee, and other states to somehow increase the reimbursement to the medical providers. You know, I guess a little bit more comparative data would help us as lay people better target areas that need to be looked in a little bit closer. At least that's my initial impression. What are your thoughts based on that? Those comments?
Commissioner Justin.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I'm happy to get you some comparative data. This had to be necessarily pretty high level.
Yep.
But I think it's probably easier to kind of break it down by which area. So if you want to, like, compare what we spend on administrative expenses for with the HMOs, kind of that's one level of comparison. We can look at how much, you know, administrative dollars go towards, like, in our dental area. You know, and I think then there are two levels of that. There's what we would spend at the department, because we certainly, if we're going to have contract with someone to spend billions of dollars, we have some oversight to that. But then some administrative costs, for example, at the plans or at the providers, too. But we can look for what is available. Certainly that's something, for example, in child we look at in child support and in some of our children's areas outside of healthcare as well.
And just really quick, if I'll interject, just for members know, tomorrow for our joint hearing, we are going a little bit more over the public programs, including Medicaid waivers, things like that, that DHS administers. So there will be a lot of time for questions tomorrow with some of these details. But to just for members' information.
Madam Chair, do you have other people want to ask questions?
I have a couple. Yep.
Okay. I'll pass because we're almost at the end here. I'll wait till tomorrow or whenever
that's
we get
fair.
At that.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Jensen, I want to refer you to page or slide number 18.
Madam Chair, Representative, mine aren't numbered, so could you tell me?
This would be the slide that highlights the percent of uninsured Minnesotans. And first, a bit of clarification: when we're speaking about determining eligibility, that would be for, as you said here, programs supported or sponsored or subsidized by the state of Minnesota. And so, just a point of clarification: when we talk about the drop in the uninsured rate, I'm wondering if you could clarify or expand on the percent that speaks to that enrolled in, or is it entirely relevant to public programs as opposed to private programs that people are enrolling in? And I know we'll get in the weeds on this as the weeks to come, but I'm just wondering if you could highlight for the committee members what determination is between the relationship between public and private programs when you look at that graph, which to my way of thinking is a bit in conflict with the verbiage to the left of it.
Commissioner Justin.
Madam Chair, Representative, you're right, the graph talks about the percentage of uninsured Minnesotans overall, not just those on public programs. So I certainly wasn't trying to mislead anyone, so I apologize for that. But I do think, while it's very clear that the drop in the uninsured rate is not attributable just to public programs, so you're absolutely right about that, I think that public program enrollment played a large part in that drop in the uninsured rate. And I don't think this should, from my perspective, surprise us, because what we knew from studies in the health department several years ago was that 60% of people who are uninsured in Minnesota were eligible for one of our public programs but just hadn't enrolled. And that was before the second part of the Medicaid expansion. So yes, we're certainly not claiming credit for all of that, but there has been a significant increase in public program enrollment for people who are eligible.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Jensen, I want to take us back to what we do. Because you kind of went through that really quick. And I would just like to point out the highest group. It's on page 19. The highest group of the population that's in poverty is 0 to 4. And when I think about that and think about as we work towards creating the world best workforce, but also creating equitable outcomes for all our children in our educational system, and the need for early child education, and I'm going to assume that, maybe you can tell me, that within the child welfare system, parents who are on that system are receiving CCAP dollars if they need it for work or school, or that's a question first.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran. I put that slide on there because I am troubled by those statistics, and I think it's one of the challenges, I'm going to come to that in a minute as well, that we face. So not everyone who qualifies for child care assistance gets it. If your child and your parent is on our welfare or infant program, then you're entitled to it. But other people are entitled to kind of it on a basic sliding fee scale, and we have a long waiting list for those slots.
Representative Moran.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Jensen. So I think that's to my point, because I know within my district there are many parents who are working, many of them not full-time, but they're out of the house 2 or 3 times, maybe a week, mm-hmm. and they don't have assistance, and they're on a waiting list for the basic child care sliding fee. So I think that's a pretty big problem right now, a concern, that, as we work to creating equitable outcomes, but also just looking at all the research around the adverse childhood experiences around brain development that happens those first 3 years, and that here we have a great big population of our youngest population who have not been served in a way that would, prepare them to enter kindergarten ready and prepared and reading by third grade. So you will be talking more about this subject.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, I will be talking about it, maybe not just today, but across the session.
Yes.
And if Commissioner Jessen, if you want to, that's the end of the questions that we have right now. If you want to finish your presentation, and then we'll have you just introduce some of the faces that you think we might want to recognize, and we'll be wrapping up here in just a couple minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next slide is really about our mental health service capacity that, all of Minnesota, we have a health care shortage for mental health workers and a pretty fragile mental health system. Now, this slide talks about mental health, but I would say we also kind of have huge workforce challenges in our long-term care area as well, mental health. I know there are other workforce issues, but that is a challenge for us as we try and manage the mental health system and all of our healthcare systems. And this really, I think, next slide gets to what Representative Moran perhaps was talking about, and this goes to the challenge of having so many of our children that live in deep poverty. And this is a graph that just shows you kind of the basic monthly cash assistance across the last number of years versus the cost of housing. So we kind of particularly just addresses the challenge of housing for poor families. And back to the more mundane level, it's our challenge with our technology. To run all these systems, as I said, we really depend upon IT, and not only is some of our technology more than 20 years old, it's more than 30 years old, and this is a challenge for us. It also kind of relates to the workforce challenge. So when we try and fix a system, you know, that is so such a legacy system, you know, you can't go and just hire people out of school who know how to do COBOL. You know, we have to go back and try and convince someone come out of retirement who retired 20 years ago to come and help us. So this is a big challenge, and it's a challenge for us, but it is also, of course, an equal challenge because we share our systems with the counties for our county partners. I just wanted to kind of come back on the dollars front to show you, at least based on the November forecast, how much of our funding comes from the federal government. You know, most of that is because of the medical assistance match that, you know, 50% that I talked about for our biggest program, as well as opposed to the direct appropriations from the state. And, Madam Chair, members, I'm happy to take more questions. Oh, you want me to introduce? I apologize.
No, that's okay. If you just want to, Commissioner, if you want to just introduce some people that you think we might want to know who they are, what they do, and then we'll make sure there's no further questions and we'll wrap up.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, let me ask where Amy Delwa, where are you, Amy? I was going to say, Madam Chair, that Amy Delwo is kind of our overall department legislative liaison, and just a great, you're not sure who to call at the department, call Amy and she will find things for you. Or, you know, call me. That's easy to find. I'm trying to make sure I know who all is here. Nathan Morocco, would you stand up? Nathan is our Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare. So you'll be seeing a lot of Nathan, and he came to us actually about a little over a year ago from NMB, where he ran the CGET program for many years. And let's see, Alex Bartolik. Alex, you want to stand up? I know people will be seeing a lot of Alex. She's our Division Director in Disability Services. Now, if I start doing this, I'm going to miss people, but Jean, you want to stand up, who's Executive Director of the Board on Aging, so a lot of our work in aging, she really drives.
Jerry.
Jerry. Okay, thank you. see, if Amy was here, this is Jerry Kerber, who I spoke of. And Jerry, I say good things about you, and I didn't even know you were in the audience. And Jerry is our Inspector General, so a lot of kind of the fraud, licensing, background study questions, you know, Jerry is our go-to person and has been for many years. Who else? Missing anyone else over here? Oh, I can't see that book. Oh, and... Sorry, I couldn't see Anna and Brunel. Would you stand up? So this is Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry and Assistant Commissioner Brunel Mack, who they live and breathe our direct care areas. So, you know, these are people, the fact that they could both be at one place without being called away is actually kind of amazing. trying to look over at this side. Anyone else? Okay, I think that about covers it.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you to the Department of Health, Department of Human Services, for the overview. Just a reminder, members, we have one more joint hearing tomorrow, same time, same place, to hear a little bit more from DHS on the programs they administer. And with that, we're adjourned. Hello.